there. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Anna David. And today I have a great guest. He's somebody that I interviewed for Entrepreneur Magazine last year. And we talked, first of all, I heard a word that I had never heard. I pride myself on being quite savvy in the entrepreneurial world. Have you ever heard of an intrapreneur? If you have, you are ahead of me. I learned about that. And you, through this, will learn about what happens when you have a stroke the week of your big book release. I talked to this wonderful guy about surviving cancer, the stroke, and how he's been able to experience this darkness and still find his light. His name is Brian Kurtz. He's been a serial direct marketer for almost 40 years, and he actually has the longest bio I've ever seen. So I'm not going to read it. Instead, I'm going to tell you to go to overdeliverbook.com. Get that book. You heard what he went through to get you that book. And he talks about how he overdelivers in that book and that and what you can get if you go to there. So go to that URL, overdeliverbook.com, and please, please, please enjoy my conversation with Brian Kurtz.
Okay, so you were saying to me, Brian, you were not born with a silver spoon in your mouth, but you didn't have a sort of, I went bankrupt, I got it all. Like, you had a slow and steady build, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it was like, I was born a poor child, but I was born to, a middle-class family. I didn't have a lot, but I had enough. And my parents, would say, when I went to college, it was like, you can go to a state school or you can go to a state school.
Right.
So it was like, but that was fine. And so I was used to that. And then my first job at a college was like, $9,000 a year. I got a big raise when I went to Boardroom for $12,500. And it was like the biggest deal in the world. So that's kind of like my hero's journey, but it doesn't go through, an attempted suicide. It doesn't go through bankruptcy. It doesn't go through those things. But it's an interesting story because, I'm not a startup guy. I'm an entrepreneur now, but I'm not a startup guy. So that's another thing that I don't have. But I went to a company with a guy who was an entrepreneur who took me under his wing. I became an intrapreneur.
What is that?
So an intrapreneur is I had some entrepreneurial tendencies, but I didn't have this burning need to run my own company. But what Marty Edelstein, who was the founder of Boardroom, he was a control guy, but over time, when he trusted you, he started giving you more responsibility. And then, 10 years into the company, I was, became a partner in the company. I got a lot more freedom to do what I wanted to do with his, with his blessing, of course. And then he had a stroke in 2001. And at that time, I started running most of the marketing, and we actually had our biggest years ever. Not bragging, it just happened. Biggest years ever in 2005, 6, and 7, when we got into the infomercial business and we got into a lot of other things. So, it was a gradual, as you said, it was a gradual build to something that was very entrepreneurial, but I didn't have to worry. I mean, I had to worry about the payroll as a team, but I didn't have all of that on my head. I never want to, say I'm somebody that I'm not. And so I'm not the guy, that had the total purse strings all the time, but I was involved in all those decisions. And that, I think, prepared me very well for when I went out on my own 5 years ago. And so, but it's all, it's all my story and it's what I got. And it's good, but it's, if anybody is tuning in to hear an amazing hero's journey, it's a little different than a lot of the ones.
I disagree. I still don't know what intrapreneur means, though.
It means that you're in an entrepreneurial company and you're given the leeway to be entrepreneurial in the company. Wow. So you get to, call some of the shots, but not all of them. And over time, I got to call all of them, but I wasn't calling them at the beginning. It really is a, I guess it's a, it's really taking on the responsibility slowly, not jumping into owning the business and owning everything and every decision. And that was, you know, and so I really felt like an entrepreneur, even though I didn't start the company. That's probably the best definition.
It kind of sounds dreamy, frankly.
It is, because I didn't have to launch it and I didn't have to go through the growing pains of, you know, I got to the company in 1981. It was about a $5 million company. And I look at my trajectory in that company to when I left to 2015, and in our height, we were at like 157 million. Now, So I can see myself as a business grower, but not necessarily someone who's going to start a $157 million business. I had to do it with partners and a lot of staff and all of that. Knowing I did that, now I'm not interested in staff. I'm not interested in overhead. I'm not interested in any of those things, because I did it for 40 years. And now my goal is to teach it. So that's kind of my story.
Okay. So things are going along. You have, according to you, you know, a pretty normal-ish, normal for a very successful person. And then your struggles came later, as in very recently. So let's talk about those.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first one wasn't life or death, but I was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2008. Mm-hmm. That wasn't, you know, I got diagnosed. It was stage two. I realized that I probably can get out of this pretty easily with surgery. And I was 50 years old. And it was like, okay, the guy said, look, you can wait, you cannot wait, but you're 50 years old, you play tennis, you umpire baseball, you're active, you should, you know, probably get your prostate taken out, and chances are you're going to die of something else besides prostate cancer. And that's what I did. It wasn't a big setback. It really wasn't. I think it might have been a setback more for, you know, other people, but it wasn't a big setback for me. But it was a little bit of a wake-up call. I went on after that, a couple of years after that, I realized that, you know, the survival nurses at Sloan Kettering, where I was being treated, said to me, look, I don't know why you got prostate cancer, but you have a body that probably makes cancer. And so what are you going to do about it? And I didn't do anything about it for 2 years. And then all of a sudden, I got religion. I went to Dr. Mark Hyman, who's an awesome functional medicine doctor, to his Ultra Wellness Center. I swore myself off sugar. I swore myself off all gluten. And I took supplements. And I, you know, not that I became an Adonis, but I became, like, you know, pretty good for 50 years old or 53 years old. And so that's the way. So that's the first, like, yep, you know, real, you know, but it wasn't like a come to Jesus moment, because it wasn't like I was going to die. It wasn't like that I felt that it was going to be that this was the turnaround moment. Now I'm going to live. That right. wasn't at all. So then I go perking along. I leave boardroom. I start my business 5 years ago. And I had written a book already, The Advertising Solution, which we did a piece.
An entrepreneur story, yep.
And then I wrote my opus. I wrote the book that I over-deliver that I've been working on it for the last year. And it comes out April 9th. And I had just finished, like, running a mastermind group. I was going to Chicago and Nashville. And I came home, and I was 61 years old. And I went into the bathroom. I got up in the morning. I went into the bathroom. I kissed my wife. I walked out of the bathroom, and I collapsed on the floor. The only thing I remember was that the right side of my body was paralyzed. I couldn't lift my arm. It was, like, frightening, scary. But then I think I passed out, so I don't even know what happened.
And this was, to clarify for anyone who's listening who knows when, this is 2000, we're recording this in August of 2019, and this is April. Okay.
Right. So April 10th, 2019, my wife, you know, alertly called 911, rushed me to the hospital. I was out. I don't know what happened. I don't know what was happening with my family when they were there and what they were doing. And I must have gotten up two days later, and I had a very severe stroke. I was I woke up and the doctors didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. I clearly was not paralyzed, so that was a good thing. I lost sight in my left eye. That's probably the only thing.
And still. Then
what's that?
Still.
Oh yeah, yeah. I lost the sight. That's gone. But I started walking around the hospital, and they were checking me out and testing me and all of that. And they basically said to me that you're in a 5% group that would have this stroke and have this outcome.
Wow.
And so, you know, I was already grateful, you know, for my outcome because I was alive, but I was even more grateful that I only, you know, had this minor thing. So 5 days later, I checked out. I didn't have to go to physical therapy. I didn't have to go to speech therapy. And then the recovery began, and I had to cancel my mastermind, which was in May, which was brutal. I had to cancel. And I had all this stuff lined up to launch my book, you know, podcasts and all kinds of stuff. And it was hard at first, but then I started canceling things and started clearing my schedule out, and with an eye towards the fall when my next mastermind was, when I was going to do another speaking engagement, and I had to get ready for that. But again, interestingly, going back, you know, when I go back to 2008 with my cancer diagnosis, and this was life or death. I mean, this was, I came that close to dying. And I realized that I still didn't have a come to Jesus moment. And that was an epiphany for me, because it wasn't a matter of how severe the health situation was. And it was a great feeling to know, even though I was a little depressed, even though I couldn't really function completely, I had to clear out my schedule and all that. I realized that if I had died, I wouldn't have known it. I woke up and I didn't have this feeling like, oh, now I have to live. And it was very, with all the rough feelings I was having at the time, it was a very, every once in a while, I would just sit back and say, wow, I don't like to talk about legacy because legacy sounds like you're dead. And so, but I think my legacy, I mean, the fact that I wrote the book, the fact that I developed this site for my book, that was this incredible resource site, overdeliverbook.com, that had 11 amazing bonuses from my mentors, alive and dead. I had put out, not only then, but I had put out over 40 years, a decent amount of stuff. And was it enough? I don't know. I mean, you know, in Hamilton, the show Hamilton, they say, there's a song in there, Alexander Hamilton. They say, you know, why do you write like you're running out of time? I don't think I was doing stuff because I was running out of time. I was just at a pretty good pace because I wanted to keep moving. I wanted to keep doing. And so a couple of things after, you know, after I started, and now I'm back, you know, moving, I'm doing podcasts, I'm speaking to you, which is great. And I'm realizing that I'm here and I have so much more to give. And that has been incredibly satisfying. The other thing that I thought about, and it's a movie I saw before my stroke, but I started thinking about it after my stroke, which is the movie Coco. I don't know if you've seen it. It's Coco
Chanel.
No, it's Coco. It's a animated Pixar.
No.
Okay.
No.
Watch it. It's amazing.
Okay.
It's a kid's film, but it's not a kid's film.
Yeah.
So it's a And the premise of the film is about, it's Mexican, and it's a Mexican film, and it's about Dia de Muertos, which mm-hmm. is a holiday in Mexican tradition where once a year you celebrate the dead. You celebrate the people that, you know, that are in your family and people you admire. And it's not, as far as I can tell, based on what they were doing in the movie, it was not a day of mourning. It was a celebration. And then I won't give away the whole movie, but the premise is that you're only really dead when you're no longer remembered. So when you die, as long as you're remembered, you live on.
Alive, right.
And if you're not remembered anymore, that's when you crumble and die. And I realized that I probably, had a bunch of years to be remembered and that I wouldn't really die for at least a little while. And that was, comforting to some degree when I thought about what could have been, that I came, very close to dying. And so that was really important. And then when I realized that my site, my overdeliverbook.com site, was honoring mentors that were both dead and alive. And that was really, I didn't know it when I did it, but when I went back to look at the site and I honored, people like Dick Benson and Gene Schwartz, who are greats of marketing, and they're dead. And then I also had the honor of honoring Dan Kennedy and Gary Bensavenga and Jay Abraham, who wrote the foreword to my book. And so that felt really good, because why not be remembered while you're alive?
Right.
So all of this was kind of like my unwrapping of the stroke, and it's been a really, really great process. I don't want to say I'm glad I had a stroke. I'm glad I had a stroke because my mother, who was 94 and, not the most agreeable person all the time, my stroke turned her around. I didn't, she almost lost her 61-year-old son, and she's 94 and she's in great shape. And God, that alone was okay, maybe I should have a stroke, every couple of years, because she's going to be around for another 10 or 15. So there were I started looking at all the positives, despite, having to battle through my recovery and battle through the sadness and battle through whatever I had to battle through. And I had not talked about it at this level yet, maybe with my shrink, but I haven't really talked about it. And you put out a post on Facebook and said, I didn't know if it was going to be meaningful or not, but I said, what the hell? You said, has there been a struggle? I think you said a struggle in mm-hmm. life, and how'd you get past it? And I just had happened to me. So I figured, what the hell? I'll call Anna and
it was
say,
meant to be.
Yeah, I think there was a podcast here.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. You said so many interesting things, Brian. I just, consider this, therapy number two, it's just that everybody gets to listen.
I got to pay you another $185 an hour too.
Oh, I'm 300. Oh, I'm 300? So sorry. Okay. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. You said so many things that were just, I think would help so many people, and I do want to say, I posted in the Genius Recovery, in the Genius Network group, I decided to switch the focus of this podcast from being about recovery to being about overcoming any struggle. And what I'm fascinated by is, why do some people have struggles and they fall under the wave? And why do some people sort of surf the wave? What is that? Who are these survivors? And I also love to talk to successful people about what they did. And to show people, from the outside, especially in our Instagram world, it can look like, oh, look at this guy. He just,
Front stage, backstage, right?
Yeah. It's like, he didn't even have to take a risk, an entrepreneur, whatever the word you just taught me. And then he just gets to keep building and building. He's in Strategic Coach and Genius Network and all this stuff. And nobody gets off scot-free.
That's true. That's a really good way to look at it. And I would say that, If to answer the question, maybe, I'm not sure, but to answer the question, not that I've lived my life perfectly. I've made a lot of mistakes. I still make mistakes. There a couple of them are outlined in my book, but I think the the key to the before and after was that, and when I said I didn't have a come to Jesus moment, that now I can live because I didn't live before, you have to live before. I mean, that's fairly obvious. But I think I realized I was living a pretty good life and wasn't great, wasn't like great all the time. And I'm not, I don't do a lot of posting on Facebook because, you know, I think you got to post the bad stuff and the good stuff. And I don't want to post either. So it's okay. But I think that I know that there's both. But I also know that net, I've got a pretty good lifestyle, a pretty good life, and I'd like to be around for another 30 years. So yeah. It's worth it. It's really worth it. And if I can do it, it's great. But I think you have to be like, you have to have some kind of like steady state that says, okay, this is bad beforehand. This is bad, but I can get over it. And then afterwards, same thing. This is bad, but I can get over it. And it's kind of the same thing. The bad afterwards with the stroke that I had was definitely difficult, but I'm not going to say I'm glad I had the stroke. I'm not going to say that. That's too cliched, but I had it. As you said, no one gets off scot-free anytime, and you have to take each thing as it comes. And I did. And I'm going to use it to my advantage because I have no other choice.
And this idea of a legacy and your clear pride in your book, I want to talk about that. And the irony of it being called over-deliver, when here you are potentially over-delivering this book to the world and this crisis happens that week. Have you thought about that?
I did. You know, just recently I did. Another friend of mine said that, you know, there's a story. Yesterday, this woman said to me, isn't that, I mean, I didn't even think it was a story, but you know, that the day you were going to launch, the day after you had a stroke, and there's something to that, I think. I mean, and if it's not, we'll make it something, you know, because it's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, so what did, quote, cause the stroke then? Did the doctors have theories?
Yeah. I mean, it was an AFib. So it was an irregular heartbeat that I'm wearing a heart monitor now to see if I'm an AFib all the time or if it just was a one-shot deal. But the AFib then caused a blood clot up here, I think. And that, you know, basically caused the blood flow to the brain to stop. And thank goodness there was the guy at the hospital, they had a neurosurgeon at the hospital who specializes in this technique where, you know, he goes up, you know, with a tube up, you know, not through your butt, but through your like back hip. Uh-huh. And he goes right up. He takes the clot out. I mean, this is how they explained it to me. Takes the clot out and, you know, and then you see what happens. You see what the damage is because it's a matter of how much time. It's a matter of probably what kind of shape you're in. All these things go into it. And all I can say is, so that was the reason for it. Now I'm looking with a cardiologist about what might have been the cause of that. But I remember when I went to see that doctor, the neurosurgeon, probably 2 weeks after I got out of the hospital, and I walked into his office, you know, just like, you know, my arms were both moving, my legs were both moving, my mouth was moving, unfortunately. He looked at me and he goes, I can't believe you're here.
Right.
And that's when it hit me how severe it was. Cause my family, they were sitting in the waiting room, like probably thinking, you know, it was touch and go, which it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't have any sense of that because I got up, I was fine. And that's the first I got the sense that was an amazing moment.
Right.
When I realized what I put my family through. So then I started thinking, you know, why did I do that? You know, how can I put my family through that? What a terrible thing to do, right?
Yeah, not your fault.
Yeah, not my fault, but you know. And so between that and then learning recently that, you know, 5% of the people that have my kind of stroke end up with basically very little, paralysis, physical speech therapy, all that, mm-hmm. that it was it's kind of hit me a few times still. I mean, it's not over, but it's hit me quite a few times. But I'm very much in action, you know, back in, you know, I'm doing, my schedule is a little lighter. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be on your podcast, though, so maybe this story is worth it. But I just wanted to tell it because it was, and, you know, the book is kind of my focus, and my mastermind is my focus. And I'm going to be at Joe's, at Genius Network, in November. I can't wait. You know, I'm looking forward to all the things that I was looking forward to that I had to cancel back in April. And that is, that's a gift.
So let's talk about this book. So people can get it on Amazon and these bonuses. Oh, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Don't get it on Amazon. Go to overdeliverbook.com. If you want to buy the book, you'll see an amazing bonus page. It's just phenomenal. I have a Jay Abraham course that he put together that he doesn't sell anymore. Cost him a couple $100,000 to do, and that's on there digitally, plus 21 keynotes that he gave. I have two books in PDF form that are by pioneers in direct mail. Not that the book is about direct mail, but I talk about direct mail in the book, how paying postage made me a better marketer, and how, you know, that prepared me for the internet and all of that. And those two books by Dick Benson and Gordon Grossman are phenomenal books, and they're not readily available. There's a swipe file from Dan Kennedy. There's a Bensavenga Bullets. Gary Bensavenga is probably the best living copywriter, and he has these Bensavenga Bullets, and I just accumulated them and created a PDF. I have a swipe file going back to 1900 of some of the best direct mail. And you say, oh, why do I want to look at direct mail? Of course you want to look at direct mail. You can, you know, you can get headlines and subject lines and all sorts of things and copy platforms from swipes. So it's, and the beauty of it is that it's an over delivery of, you have a book called Over Deliver. You got to over deliver on the,
yeah,
on the bonuses. And it's also a direct marketing kind of rule of thumb that says always give the customer more than they ever would have wanted. So you got to give them enough to buy the book, and the book's like $17, and the bonuses are worth thousands. And I'm very proud of that too. I'm very proud of the, I'm as proud of the bonuses as I am of the book. And I think the book is good. I think, you know, there's nothing in the book that I invented per se, but it's things that are maybe not known by a lot of online marketers, like concepts like the 40-40-20 rule and RFM and lifetime value. And I probably tell those concepts in stories that might be a way for a new audience to access it. And that kind of is my mission. My mission is like, I'm not going to tell you maybe anything you never heard of or that it's new, but I'm going to give you an understanding based on how I experience those concepts. And that's really, really important. And it all goes back to, everything goes back to one thing. It's something that I guess Jay Abraham told me. He said, you know, those who did it have a responsibility to teach it. And he said, it's like, you know, when you're done doing it, make sure that you teach it. He said, leave a legacy, but I just want to leave enough. I want to leave the campsite clean, but I want to leave it with a lot of stuff that you can use and you can, and so I think it really fulfills on that promise. If I had died on April 10th, it still would have been there, you know. But now I'm more, how should I say it? I'm more eager to share it and to make sure that I can share it with, you know, on podcasts and when I'm on stage and when I'm, you know, anywhere I can share it, I really want to share it. So overdeliverbook.com, it's a great site. It lets you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever you want to buy the book. You come back, you input your email address, then you get my blog every Sunday, and you put your order number in and you get access to these amazing bonuses.
And why did you decide to release the book that way?
You know, there were some people that told me, many people told me, the only way to sell a book is free plus shipping and handling with a funnel.
Yeah.
And I thought about it. I can, you know, buy the book at a fairly decent cost and probably be able to do that and create a course behind it and all, you know, an ascension program to my mastermind and all of that. And I thought about it, and I maybe because I'm too lazy to do that. I don't know. But I think the reason is that I didn't want to give away my book for free. Not that they have to pay a mint for it either, but I really believe that if you believe in the content as much as I do with this book, then, you know, I felt better about making them pay for it, but then over delivering on the bonuses. So they get thousands of dollars worth of stuff. They get on my list, and I don't do affiliates, but, you know, I sell some of my other products. I talk about my mastermind. And someday there'll be people who bought my book that might end up buying more stuff from me. Mm-hmm. Do I have to put them in a funnel? Well, I'm leaving money on the table by not doing that, but I'm okay with it. And I kind of talk myself into this. And then in addition, Dean Jackson and I were, he came to my mastermind, he spoke, and we were talking about this concept of, and I call it fishing without bait. And so, you know, you're in a boat on a lake and you throw your pole in the water with, you know, bait on it, and the fish in the water are your prospects or whatever, it's your list. And some bite, you bring them in, you hope to they pay for the product or they don't return it, and then you sell them a lot more, that's your funnel. So it could be free push shipping and handling in this case, and then you sell them other stuff. Perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. What Dean and I talked about was instead of that, I want to get you on my list, give you just information that I can share. I have blog posts. In fact, one of the bonuses on overdeliverbook.com is the lost chapters of Overdeliver. And what that is everything I've written since last August when the book went to the press. Wow. And that's another 178 pages. So that's what I do every week. And so the difference between putting a pole in the water with bait is that you're shining a light on the lake all the time. And that's your content. And the fish can see it, but they're not doing anything because they're not ready.
Right.
And the point is that when they're ready, the fish will jump into the boat. And that, so again, to answer your question, I like that model better. It's more congruent with who I am and who I've been my whole career. And not that free plus shipping and handling isn't a wonderful model, but it wasn't for me. And I decided to go with this. And I may not sell as many books, but the books I sell will be incredible people. It'll be a list of quality as opposed to quantity.
Yeah.
I'm really good about it.
That's interesting. It's a lot of what we talked about back when I interviewed you about a year ago for Entrepreneur Magazine.
I think it was. It was about the list, right?
Yeah. And it was, you were like, I'm happy if I get 10 new people on my list. I'm not going for 1,000.
Right.
So, okay. This is fascinating. I thank you so much. I have a sort of, don't let these two words together stress you out, but a lightning round for that I always ask people at the very end. What is your morning routine?
My morning routine is, first of all, after seeing Arianna Huffington speak at Joe's Genius Network event a couple of years ago, my phone is sleeping. I don't bring it upstairs. Yeah, it's downstairs. So the first thing I do is not check my phone. So that's what I don't do. I don't really meditate, but I try to, you know, sit on the edge of my bed, think about my day, go in and brush my teeth, but it's not anything extravagant. And then I go downstairs, I have coffee, I still don't grab my phone. I just try to think about, you know, get my day in order. I do the prompts from the 5-minute journal, which are, you know, what are you grateful for today? What are 3 things that if they happen today, it'd be really cool. And then some affirmations. And then I start, you know, I go to my phone, and then I go right downstairs and go on my computer, which is easier than my phone. and I start checking email and all of that. But I got some time in the morning where I don't do much except think, and I try to eat something, you know, something nutritional or something.
I love it. What is a book that has changed your life?
I have three that I think. So one is Breakthrough Advertising by Gene Schwartz. Mm-hmm. It's the most amazing book because it looks like a book on marketing and copywriting, but it's a book about human nature and human behavior. And I sell it, so that's one reason why I love it. But I wanted to sell it because I love it. Mm-hmm. And Gene has been introduced to a whole new generation of marketers, and it's so refreshing to do that. And then the other two that are really meaningful to me are The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. I read that since my stroke, you know, just reminding myself of what my personal legend is, not legacy, but what my personal legend is. And it was very valuable. And the third is kind of I thought it was going to be a throwaway book, and it's a great book called Give and Take by Adam Grant.
Yeah.
And that's, I have a little section in my book about it because it's so powerful. Givers, takers, matchers. And I think, you know, they always say, you know, who are the people that are least successful? They're givers. Who are the most successful? They're givers. And then, you know, how you give and how you contribute to other people. I mean, I have a whole section in my book about the power of 100-0, which I kind of took from the Landmark Forum, but I also kind of took it from give and take. I saw a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. But you can't do 100-0 with everybody because there are takers out there.
Yep.
That's the differentiator. And that's why Adam Grant's book was so meaningful.
Do you have a favorite quote?
I got a bunch. You only go through life once. You might as well be the world's best. I've got life is long as opposed to life is short, which was very meaningful to me recently.
Yeah.
And then I have some business ones, which is follow the anecdotal evidence that, you know, most things have been invented before. And, you know, how I got into the infomercial business, for instance, I wanted to get into it in 1989. I couldn't find the answer. I got to the answer in 2004 when I had insomnia and I saw an infomercial and it clicked. And I just followed the anecdotal evidence. That one took me a long time, but I also believe first find out if you have a business, meaning that if you're going to launch something or start something, what are the minimal tests that you have to do to find out if you have a business before you can move on, as opposed to try all the testing all at the beginning and all of that. Those are some quick ones, but
good. I love it. I always ask about mentors. You've already mentioned you've had many.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I got a bunch. If I look at my book, it's everybody who gave me a blurb. But, you know, Marty Edelstein, who's not alive anymore, he's the founder of Boardroom. He's the one that basically made me an entrepreneur and entrepreneur. And he's probably the number one. But, you know, Dan Kennedy, Gary Bensavenga, Jeff Walker, Dan Sullivan, those are some of the big ones. And then, you know, people like Richard Viguerie and Frank Kern and Bill Bonner and Joe Polish and Joe Sugarman. And just, you know, I said before, at the beginning, I said, you know, the whole thing about your mentors choose you, you don't choose your mentors.
Yeah.
I did a video on that, and it's a short video. And basically what it says, and I'm sure you know this because you're in tune with this very much, that, you know, that you can't go around and say, you know, will you be my mentor? Will you be my mentor? Will you be my mentor? Doesn't work that way. It works because you contribute. This is what Joe talks about in Genius Network. You have to contribute to somebody with no expectation of a return. And if it's someone you want them to be your mentor, contribute more to them without expectation of return. And some of my most amazing mentors, Gene Schwartz, Dick Benson, you know, many others that I figured out something that I had that they needed. In those two cases, it was list knowledge. I helped them with their list plans. I helped them, no charge, no nothing, didn't expect anything. And I got them to be my mentor for my entire life.
Yeah.
And if it weren't, it still would have been great doing that for them. But that's kind of the attitude you have to have. And your mentors will choose you. And I've done it for, you know, the same way for 40 years. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It works way more than it doesn't.
Yeah, I have seen the same thing. Now, what is your best quality?
Some people say I'm the I don't know if this is a compliment or not. They say I'm the nicest guy in direct marketing.
Mm-hmm.
I always say I'm a kinder, gentler Dan Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think it's that, you know, it's based on a quote, I think. And it was a quote from Lee Richter, who gave me this quote. And it was, she spoke at my mastermind, and she got up there and she says, "I walk in a room and I don't expect anything." And I think I'm this, I may want something at some point from that room, with a hot seat or with a question or something like that. But I always walk in a room not expecting anything.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I get so much more. So I guess that's the quality. And maybe it's that I over deliver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that I'd like to think I over deliver.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for some people I don't, but I think for many people in my life I do. And so that would probably be my best quality.
I forgot to ask, spiritual practice. Do you have one?
You know, it's not religious, that's for sure. But it's what I call serendipitous, serendipitous good fortune. And what I mean by that, and going back to 100-0, so I'm giving 100-0 here, 100-0 here, and this person doesn't give me anything for my 100. And then maybe I do another 100 or I do another 80 and they still don't give me anything. At some point I might give up or I might not, I don't know. But if I do that and then something comes out from over here that had nothing to do with that, I consider that connected.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's yep. Kind of like serendipity. So that's, I think that's kind of spiritual, is it? I mean,
well, it's having faith.
Yes.
That whatever you do will pay off often in unexpected ways.
Yes. Yeah. So that would be my spiritual practice.
What's your worst quality?
I think it's, you know, sometimes it's not getting so wound up with all of this over delivery and giving that I sometimes neglect the people closest to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working on that. I've been married for 34 years. So I work on it every day. I work on it with my kids. And I don't want them, because they're the most important thing to me. And I guess you tend to take them for granted. So I think maybe taking some things for granted, and certainly the stroke helped me get that in line a little bit more, and that was really useful.
And how do you define dark emotionally?
Dark for me is if I think that, these are really good questions. I'd say dark for me is if I think that I'm being arrogant, or if my ego takes over, or if, I mean, I want to share and I want to not show off, but I want to brag about what I've done, but not in an arrogant way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I think that, you know, there's a thin line between confidence and arrogance, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And if I feel like I've crossed over into arrogance with somebody, or in some speech I gave or something I wrote or something like that, it stays with me for a longer time than a lot, almost anything else. So that's a dark place for me. And in fact, I always read the 1-star reviews on Amazon before I read the 5-star. And one of the 1-star reviews for my book was someone who said, you know, Brian needs to get over himself, or Brian needs to, you know, he's too, you know, it was about me being kind of braggadocious and all of that. And like, I work so hard to not have that in my book. So there's enough in my book that this guy got it. And so I, you know, it, that's a little dark for me, but I don't stay there too long, but I want to have that dark moment so that, you know, all of the Brian, you're the greatest, doesn't go to my head, and, you know, it keeps you grounded.
And how do you define, last question, how do you define light?
Light, when I was, you know, I realized when I was depressed right after my stroke, I had very little light. And so what gave me light would be the best way I can think of it right now, because it's current. And it was sharing my experiences, being with people, like, you know, not having been at an event for like, you know, 3 months, like, you know, I'm like, you know, I don't have FOMO. I had TOMS, which is terrified of missing shit. I mean, I was like just missing shit. And so I can get back into that. And with my family, you know, I didn't have any visitors the first couple of months, and now I've invited my friends over, and I'm back in a mode of being with the world. And that gives me that I think that's light.
Brian, you finished. This was amazing. Anybody listening, go to Overdeliver Book.
Book.com. Yep.
.com. I can't thank you enough for this. It was lovely.
Yeah, this was great. You got this podcast thing nailed.
Well, thank you. What a great note to end on.